I wish I could take credit, but it's always the unplanned shows that go the best. Shane Toven shows up at Mark Person's house, and I ask Shane, can you do the show today? He does. We have a fantastic show. Chris Tarr is here as well, thank goodness, and we're talking about EAS, virtualizing it, and what are the problems, and what are the weak points, and can we actually solve them? All that's coming up next on TWRT.
This Week in Radio Tech is brought to you by Broadcasters General Store, with outstanding service, savings, and support, online at bgs.cc. By Broadcast Bionics, with the Bionic Studio, including talk show control, social media, and visual radio, Broadcast Bionics brings exceptional audience engagement to radio and TV. By Angry Audio, audio problems disappear when you get angry at angryaudio.com. By Nautel, worry-free transmission you can count on with outstanding control, reliability, efficiencies, and Nautel's unmatched 24/7 customer support, online at Nautel.com. And by MaxConnect Wireless, prioritized high-speed internet service designed for transmitter sites and remote broadcasts.
Hey, welcome into This Week in Radio Tech, the show where we talk about everything from the microphone to that light bulb over there at the top of the tower. I'm Kirk Harnack, so delighted to be here. Glad that you're here, too. And I mean that. And my guests, my co-hosts, my guests are just going to save the day. I'm in Nashville, Tennessee, as you can tell, my usual spot in the Telos Alliance studio here in Nashville. And I'm feeling really under the weather. I don't know. When I was in Hawaii, I felt great the whole time. Of course, why not? But as soon as I got back to Nashville, I feel like I picked up a bug and allergies and maybe both at the same time. I'm feeling awful. So guess what? You don't get to hear from me today. You don't have to hear from me today. Chris Tarr is going to be doing a lot of the talking. Chris Tarr's here, co-host up in Mequonago. Good to see you, man. How are you?
I am doing all right. Thank you. Yeah, you know, I'm actually allergies too. I got a sore throat today and I've just been plugging away. But it is like 90 degrees out here today. So I am happy. Of course, I'm in a basement right now, so it's not that happy. But a little later on after the show, I got a brand new ham radio to put in my car. I get ready for a little road trip tomorrow, so I'm looking forward to that. But yeah, it's going to be a good show today. We've got some great guests. I'm so excited for them.
I know it. I know. Chris, I was so discombobulated this week, getting sick and the jet lag coming back from Hawaii where we were last week and all that, and I misread my calendar. And so on Tuesday, I look at my calendar and I think, I don't have a guest for This Week in Radio Tech. Now, it could be me and Chris. Chris does a great job, but Chris isn't always available. And he doesn't know yet that I don't have a guest. So what am I going to do? And I thought, And then I saw a post from Shane Toven. And Shane said he was kind of on a little vacay, but he was taking care. Well, he was visiting his dad. And he was up in Minnesota's old stomping grounds. I thought, I wonder how Shane's doing. And so I texted Shane, hey, Shane, you want to be on the show this week? He said, yeah. Shane always has good stuff to talk about. And I've got some topics that I want to talk to him about, too. So Shane Toven, and better than that, I got a text 20 minutes before the show. Kirk, I hope you don't mind, but I'm sitting here with Mark Persons. That's a mind. Oh, my God. What could be better? So let's bring him in. Shane Toven and Mark Persons. Good to see both of you.
Great to see you.
Hey, Kirk.
Oh, man, I am so happy. My cold may just disappear on its own. So, Shane and Mark, tell us where you guys are and why are you together at the, what's the name of that mansion or lodge you're at?
It's called Gilbert Lodge, and it's Gilbert Lake, which is in Minnesota, center of the part of the state, Brainerd, Minnesota. And I should tell you, there's more to the story than that, because we have on this small lake, 360 acres, is a small island. So we had a name the boat contest when we got our 20-foot pontoon. And we wanted big names, names that would give confidence to anyone riding. It would be Titanic, some big name like that, Bismarck, you name it. Well, because there's a little island on the lake, it's now called, now you got me going here. It's like Gilligan's Island. So the boat's name is the Minnow, like on Gilligan's Island. And I'm the skipper.
Nice.
Paula is the first mate. She's Gilligan. But then I was thinking, well, maybe I could be Mr. Howell and she could be Mrs. Howell. She didn't buy that one at all. That one just didn't work out.
Kirk, I can't even begin to describe the just gorgeous view I've got here out the window. I wish I could share it with you. But and I've had the pleasure of being on the Minnow. Thankfully, it was not for a three-hour cruise ending in being stranded on said island. So I
would love to come visit there myself. And I think I've had an invitation in the past from the person's family to come visit them. And I expect that it's fantastic. And one reason I expect, see, Mark, you've always impressed me as someone who's a planner and then a doer. You plan your plan and then you work your plan. And you and Paula both, you seem like planners. Am I wrong or am I right about that?
You're absolutely right. And quite frankly, we built this place just like I wanted to build radio stations. We started from the ground up, and it has, and I can explain that in another episode on this fine venue. But I mean, we're talking about full backup power, because if the power goes out, it only goes out for 10 seconds. You know, a UPS that covers all 8 of the computer systems simultaneously, a 3kW UPS, the whole thing. It's built like a radio station. It's built to work. And, you know, a lot of that has to do with my writing in radio world. I enjoy doing that. I enjoy telling stories. And it's just trying to help others do the right thing in broadcast engineering.
I'm so glad you did not name that boat the Edmund Fitzgerald. That would be bad. Oh, yes. So the Minnow's a much better name. Mm-hmm.
And quite frankly, three of us in this conversation are amateur radio operators. And I remember
I think all four of us are, although I'm not very active.
All four, that's right. Okay. So talking to a special events station, and it was in Nova Scotia, the closest point to where the Titanic sunk. So that's fun to talk to those people because they're always real energetic and that kind of thing. And then he says, I'll enter you in the Titanic logbook. And I thought, ooh, is that a good idea or not?
My goodness. No, we're good. We're good, really. Just I'll send you a card. We're good.
So, oh man. Hey, guys, before we get cranked up too high here, because we do have some topics to talk about that I think are just absolutely fascinating, just to let our audience know, we want to talk about we talk about virtualization for transmitter sites, as in processing, site control, STL. Shane, and I hope Mark jumps in, and I know Chris will jump in. EAS rules, the potential discussion of EAS virtualization as well. I think it's high time that we really took a look at EAS rules and seeing if there's some better ways to handle what we're handling now that would give us more flexibility. Of course, we need to serve the public. We have to do that, get messages out on time, but we don't necessarily have to do it the way we've been doing it, which in many ways fails in lots of ways. And maybe there's some better ways to do it. And so Shane and Mark both have some things to talk about. Chris will be asking some questions and add his own comments. Speaking of comments, I want to let you know about Nautel and what they're doing for us this summer. June 6th is the next Transmission Talk Tuesday from Nautel. Go to nautel.com/webinars and click on Transmission Talk Tuesday. There you'll find links for the upcoming summer Transmission Talk Tuesday roundtable discussions. The next one is June the 6th. It's called Get Grounded. When the session runs, we're going to be in the middle of their spring and summer lightning season. We're going to talk about grounding and bonding, single point and halo grounding, and again, take a look at things that can be done to optimize existing facilities so you can modify what you've got. If it didn't start out perfectly, you can fix it. And if you've got a site that's giving some challenges with respect to failures due to storm activity, well, you can, it's a discussion. It's not a webinar. It's a discussion. Feel free to start a conversation in advance by submitting a question or bring your question up during the show itself. And Jeff and his guests will be happy to take it on as a case study during the session if you want to submit it beforehand. And by the way, you can submit a question anonymously at your discretion. Tell them, hey, I don't want them to know who I am. So if you need to, you know, tattletale on a site that you know is bad, but maybe you want to make it better, you can do that too. So nautel.com/webinars, click on Transmission Talk Tuesday, and there's the whole list of the few more sessions coming up for this summer. Get Grounded is the one for the next one for June the 6th. Hey, I'll be seeing Jeff Welton on June the 8th, a couple days after that. So, hey, hopefully I'll join you in the roundtable discussion, and I'll get to see Jeff in person at the Ennis Workshop in El Paso, Texas, coming up June the 9th, actually, Friday, June the 9th, but we're all arriving June the 8th to have a dinner at a local steakhouse. So thanks a lot, Nautel, for sponsoring This Week in Radio Tech. All right, Chris Tarr is the co-host, and he's along with Shane Toven and Mark Persons. And guys, I'm wondering if we could jump to the topic that's really hottest on my mind. And Shane, you agreed to talk about this. Maybe you can tell us something about what your employer, EMF, has in mind, because you take care of a lot of sites. You have a lot of EAS responsibility all over the country. And I'm wondering, you know, how can we do a better job of handling EAS messaging to the public, make it more reliable, and yet not make it dependent on the current hardware requirements that it has now, which you know, if there's not people involved with it who know what they're doing, it can be a little dicey making sure it works right. And maybe taking people out of it is part of the good equation. I don't know. I can tell you that in Mississippi, when we first started some of the new EAS stuff there years ago, we had a wonderful statewide dry cleaning emergency. We covered it completely. It was no problem. The Jackson, Mississippi station that originated the test forgot to hit the end tones, the duck farts at the end, and we aired dry cleaning ads and who knows what else from Jackson, Mississippi. I wasn't impressed. So, Shane, you and Chris and Mark, take it away. Tell me about EAS.
So, yeah, I mean, we've had EAS for how many years now, Mark?
Oh, I will tell you that when I was less than a teenager, it was civil defense turned into EBS, Emergency Broadcast System. And then EAS, gosh, that must have come along.
It was in the early to mid-90s.
I would say so, yeah. It seems like forever.
Yeah.
And then, of course, all the upgrades along the way.
Right. But, I mean, the system has remained largely unchanged. I mean, the basic core of how the system operates has remained largely unchanged for many years. I mean, the biggest change was from EBS to EAS, and then, of course, adding CAP into that mix. But, I mean, the two-tone alert that was the core of EBS for so many years and the broadcast daisy chain that was part of EBS for so many years was just basically carried into EAS. The only thing that EAS really added was the ability to encode some data along with those alerts to kind of indicate, you know, what they are, how long they're valid, what areas they cover, things like that. But the actual audio messages are still very highly reliant on things upstream. So you have to make sure that your monitoring sources are actually very clean. And as we know, that's not always the case and not always even possible for certain monitoring assignments. I mean, if they're expecting you to get a, you know, an AM station, 1 kilowatt AM station that's, you know, clear on the other side of the state, I mean, obviously that's not going to happen. So
what's the reliability when they've been doing testing? What are the results? How good has it been?
Chris, do you know, have they released the results of the last national CAP test?
I want to say it was close to, it was in the mid-90s percentage-wise in terms of success rates. Now, to kind of add to, and I don't want to steal your thunder here if you're going to cover this in a little bit, but with the new rules coming out this fall, some of that, you know, messages from a 1 kilowatt AM that you can barely understand, some of that will be fixed with the new changes and the new rules and the new firmware coming out, where the CAP alert will always come first if there's a separate CAP alert, to make sure that the text-to-speech is what's read first, which would be much clearer than whatever even some of the FM stations are sending. So that's part of it. But yeah, the national test, the first one was just awful. We found some hardware issues with Sage Index and a few other things, but then the second one was good. Wasn't great. You know, there were obviously some links in the chain that were broken, but definitely an improvement over the first one.
And do you remember they did or did not do CAP on that particular one? I don't think they did. Did they? That was just the daisy chain.
that was just a daisy chain, although I believe it was it started with a message to the PEP stations in each state and then generated from there. And there's also been some changes from there. At least in Wisconsin, we've now added to our PEP stations another option for entry for national EAS with the addition of either XM receivers that are tuned to their channel one, which is a national EAS source, or the NPR Squawk channel is another option. So we've been working on adding yet another pathway, and I believe that FEMA is going to require that in all the states very soon if they haven't already, with that additional pathway into the PEP stations to make it more reliable. So I think we are going to see some more alerts coming that way through CAP distribution before, you know, local alerts, just because that's really going to be where the reliability comes in, I think, on the system in the future.
Yeah, you're right. And that's an excellent point. I mean, CAP was probably one of the more revolutionary features to be introduced into the EAS system. And yeah, I know we had people, hemming and hawing about, oh, I don't want to trust the internet for my data, you know, for my EAS system. But, it makes a great adjunct to the over-the-air relay system, especially, as you mentioned, with the ability to attach audio files and a very distinct text message, with the file. I mean, so you can actually tell what that alert's all about rather than just hearing some really fuzzy message over the air. We still have that problem with NOAA weather radio because they do not enter things in CAP. So they're not part of any kind of CAP data that gets sent out.
And the accent they use it from NOAA. Oh. I mean, would you want to meet a guy who speaks like this at some local gathering or a local bar?
Perfect Paul. We all love Perfect Paul.
Yes, Perfect Paul.
Be the most boring guy you ever met.
It's a lot better than it used to be, though. When Perfect Paul first learned to talk, oh my goodness, it was terrible. But it's over the years, I think they've made a lot of improvements. And Mobile, Alabama was pronounced the same way as Mobile Homes, or they vice versa. And so they've been able to separate, you know, things that are spelled the same but pronounced differently based on context. Wouldn't you agree that Paul learned how to talk over the years?
Yeah, and it's been a couple of incarnations, actually. I mean, fun fact, some of you may remember the whole, some of you may have even worked with old DEC, or Digital Equipment Corporation, computers and hardware. They had a system called DEC Talk, which made those computers talk. And guess what the National Weather Service used when they implemented the system? They're extremely flexible, though, in terms of how you do inflections and pronunciations and things like that. So that part really comes more down to people actually taking the time to program in those exceptions to their systems. I mean, the people sending the alerts, rather.
Right. Well, and we also, and that kind of raises another issue that we really need to address at some point with EAS. In a lot of places, NWS is not a required monitoring source. It's an optional one. So some people run it, some people don't, some people receive it, but don't forward it. We really at some point need to clarify, some people in fact use that as their, their local storm alerts. Well, we run it on EAS. We need to, I think that's a discussion we have to have is, do we make that mandatory? And if we do, do we change, the speech from the National Weather Service? Can those be CAP enabled, or can they, use something, a cleaner audio file or, something like that? There's some weaknesses there for sure.
Well, I mean, there's theoretically no reason why local alerting officials could not enter weather related messages into the CAPs, into CAP data and send them along that way.
And there is. I mean, we've been doing a big push here in Wisconsin to get the local municipalities on board with CAP, to get CAP-enabled systems. And a few of the counties do, and they actually do weekly tests. But it is, part of it is financial. You've got to pay to do this. And then, the training and certification involved in order to send those messages, some municipalities kind of shy away from that. So, maybe is there a regional clearinghouse for those sorts of things? Sort of like what the DOJ does with Amber Alerts.
I kind of wonder if this might be one of those opportunities where something like these new AI engines that we're seeing might be, you know, might be helpful.
Mm. Sure. You know, and again, we were starting to head towards, EAS, kind of the discussion of virtualization and things like that. I, to be honest, I don't see that happening anytime real soon. I see this as kind of being ingrained at this point, and looking ahead at the crystal ball, it looks like FEMA and FCC really want to kind of improve the system they have versus, making any wholesale changes to it. So
one kind of clarifying point. I mean, when we talk about virtualization, we're not talking about wholesale changing the EAS system and the way it works. We're talking about basically taking the hardware and not requiring the hardware box anymore, being able to put that functionality into a virtual stack. But functionally, otherwise, it's identical to the way it's always worked. That's what really is being asked for, at least at a higher level.
Right. What will you guys identify as the weakest points of EAS? And the thing that, to me, the weakest point of EAS that makes it just awful is quality of reception and therefore quality of transmission. Now, CAP solves that to a large degree for messages that come through that system. But I hear so many, I realized this was years ago. I lived in Dallas, was listening to WBAP, and great news, talk, all going along, good conversation. And then they would always break in with the actual EAS messages. And on a typical summer afternoon in Dallas, Texas, thunderstorms are popping and tornado warnings going on. And every single one of those was just the most god-awful quality. It was just horrible to listen to. The guy sitting in the chair could have done a far better, more intelligible, more relatable job of getting that information across. And so almost every time you hear something on EAS, the quality is just awful. Now, can't we fix that weak point?
I agree completely. That's back to what we were kind of mentioning earlier. I mean, some of that comes back to the monitoring assignments for the, for these state plans. Some of it comes down to, more traffic being sent out, maybe through CAP channels instead of over the air. And some of it comes down to just, making sure that if you do send out an alert and it's text-to-speech, making sure that all of those, that it's written accordingly so that the text-to-speech engine can actually pronounce it properly.
And you have to think about public perception, too. There's the average Joe listener hearing beautiful music and talk and all this stuff. And then this garbage comes on, and that's supposed to be our federal government's way of telling us they're testing the system,
right?
And it's like, what happened?
Well, and honestly, I mean, if a station has the staffing to actually have a butt in that seat giving live emergency alerting information, I agree that that's a very valuable thing. But I mean, for unattended stations, as is so often the case now, you're right, there's a lot of room for improvement.
There's something I also, and it's probably going to be an unpopular position, but I think there's a lot of laziness in the broadcaster's part as well. I many times have had program directors come to me and want to bypass tests that are coming up or alerts that are coming up because they don't want to interrupt their programming. You've got, one contract engineer for 20 stations that doesn't have time to check the reception every week other than the logs. You see some people who don't check the logs at all that say, well, it logs it automatically, so I don't need to verify that, which is wrong. But I think there's also a lot of complacency about you just stick the box in and let it work. Now, as for reception, there are waivers that I can issue in Wisconsin for that. Now, I do require, however, that you go through a lot of steps before a waiver is issued to receive a different station. Because there's very few cases where, you're so far away from a primary station that you can't get it or that it's inaudible. But that would be one of those situations where if you came to me and said, yeah, this audio is unintelligible, I could probably give you a waiver. Or, I'm in a part of, we have an example where there's a station or a group of stations in a very northwestern part of a county that is really closer to Madison than Milwaukee. So, but they're, because of the county they're in, required to monitor Milwaukee. Well, there's a case that's kind of ripe for a waiver there. But, I do think that, that's one of the things that the FCC is trying to address with you know, with the cap stuff, is trying to replace anything just received over the air with something that is text to speech or audio file versus rebroadcast. But I think part of it too is, as broadcasters, we and engineers, we have to take the responsibility to, you know, make sure this stuff's working properly, because that's where it's going to fail, is, you know, right at the source of whatever's playing it back.
Yeah, absolutely. I completely agree. And, you know, being a daisy chain system, the problems, of course, just kind of compound as it goes down the line. You know, you have one station that's got kind of marginal receive audio, then the next station has marginal receive. It all adds up. And by the time, you know, the X station down the line gets it, it's just completely garbage.
Well, and unfortunately, the FSK tones get through the noise a whole lot better than the other audio. So, yes, you know, it doesn't take much to trip that thing open, but then, you know, everything under it could be complete noise.
Yeah. Well, hey, we got to take a quick break here and hear from our friends at Broadcast Bionics. But when we come back, I want to ask about actually using more internet distribution for EAS and see where that idea falls apart, what the weak points are. And basically, well, I'll get to it in just a minute. Hey, we're brought to you in part by our friends at Broadcast Bionics, and they got this technology that's come out that Dan McQuillan's been working on for a couple of years now, and now it's being deployed, and that is called Virtual Rack. Virtual Rack. It's a name that you want to think about and be aware of. Broadcast hardware that isn't that hard. That's what Dan calls it, Virtual Rack from Broadcast Bionics. And Dan's going to be our guest. I know I've been saying that for weeks because I'm so excited about it. But sometime this summer, we're going to have Dan on to demonstrate Virtual Rack. And, you know, I've been on the virtualization bandwagon for a long time. And one of the technologies that is helping make that more reliable and easier than ever is the software containers. Docker is the usual brand name that's associated with software containers, but there's an OCI model that describes how these things work. And, you know, data centers, they're using software containers all the time now anyway. So Virtual Rack is a hardware solution that is, it's a server, although if you're outside of the UK, you can provide your own server if it's the one they specify, and then you install the Virtual Rack software. And Virtual Rack kind of acts like a bit of an app store. It has flexibility, it has resilience, it has density, it has scalability, and you don't need to be an IT specialist in order to instantiate software containers, that is broadcast infrastructure products like audio consoles, phone systems, audio processing, things like that in containers. And what do you get with Virtual Rack? You get an all-purpose appliance, a purpose-built appliance, a server that's meant to do this. You get the Virtual Rack management software, and you get a library of applications. You pick and choose the applications, that is the broadcast infrastructure you want and need, and then it goes about and installs them for you. Now, it's still your responsibility to license those things with their respective manufacturers. In other words, Broadcast Bionics doesn't license Telos or Axia or Omnia products or any of the other brands that are available in software containers. You can also manage backups and failover. So you can start and stop applications. You can export the configuration files to use them elsewhere if you want to duplicate what you made here to somewhere else as a backup or in another city or something like that. So it gives you these amazing options for deployment, for failover, and the applications themselves. You can do a lot of different things. This is all AOIP, you know, between the different items, and plus AOIP in and out. Of course, you can use things like Axia's X nodes to get audio in and out of a system, or even micro MPX to feed baseband FM audio out. If you go to their website, Broadcast Bionics, bionics.co.uk, I should say, bionics.co.uk, and look for the Virtual Rack product. At the bottom of that page, there's a couple of videos where Dan gives some demonstrations of exactly how this works. And I saw it at the NAB show. I saw this just this past April at NAB. Dan gave me a personal demo of how this works, and wow, was I impressed. Also know that, you know, the company I work for, Telos Alliance, we make a lot of these container products, and our own engineers, our own developers are impressed with this system as well. You can install containers the usual method. It's a little tricky, a little difficult. It does require IT knowledge. You can pay the folks at my employer, TELUS Alliance, to install them for you. Or you can go to Virtual Rack from Broadcast Bionics. Stay tuned because Dan McQuillan will be on our show. He'll do a complete demo of this. In the meantime, watch those couple of videos on the bottom of that page. And as always, we really thank Broadcast Bionics, super pioneers in doing things in a very modern and efficient way for us as broadcasters. Appreciate that. All right. It's Kirk Harnack along with Chris Tarr, Shane Tovin, and Mark Persons are all here discussing right now EAS. We've got a couple other topics coming up. And what I wanted to say is, you know, if you ever look at one of those maps of where is the internet out, you know, in the world or in the U.S., and there's usual hotspots, and it's, you know, one company, one provider, maybe a backbone will go down, will take out, you know, part of the country, or providers, let's say local internet providers that depend on that one backbone, well, they'll be out, but maybe they have a backup backbone coming into their system, and they can use that for a while. I guess what I'm getting at is internet outages don't tend to be nationwide. They tend to be localized or regionalized, and there tends to be backups that still work. Hey, here in Nashville, Tennessee, a couple, three Christmases ago, we had that terrible bombing in downtown Nashville that took out a big AT&T switch center, and a whole lot of internet went down, 5G, all kinds of things, all went down. My home internet went down, AT&T fiber. But guess what? I had a Max Connect box from Josh Bone, and I could put it on the Verizon network, and I had internet here at my house. My point is that there's usually a way to get internet, even in the midst of problems. And I was just wondering, you know, instead of picking up stations over the air, and by the way, more and more facilities, and Shane, you can speak to this because you have a lot of experience. You've got all your local facility is at a transmitter site with EMF. Sometimes you have studios. I get that here and there. But many times, all your stuff's at the transmitter site, and or that's what I believe it is. And how do you pick up stations well at the transmitter site? Wouldn't it be cool if we would just pick up the streams of stations, make sure they contain EAS, make sure they're also streaming their EAS, and pick that up either at a central or regional location and use that higher quality audio to use on the air if it's not available on CAP. I've always thought that would be a great first way to do it. Use over the air as backup if you had to. Shane, anybody tell me where I'm messed up on that idea?
Well, believe me, the thought has occurred to me. And you're absolutely right about the internet in terms of, I mean, as a whole, the internet is generally pretty resilient. I mean, that's how it was designed. I mean, it was designed as a network of networks. So it's more like, you know, a bunch of spider webs than just any particular, you know, point-to-point link.
I like the way, if I want to send you an email from Minnesota to California, it might go through Italy on the way,
yep,
just because that's a better route at that moment.
Right, right. But you're right. It's always going to be that last mile that tends to be the weakest link. And especially when you're talking about sites that are, you know, transmitter sites that may be in the middle of, you know, in the middle of a cornfield somewhere, or up on a mountain in the, you know, literally in the middle of nowhere. I mean, in my case, you know, we get internet to the sites over, you know, several different means, either a VSAT network, which we run internally, that's just literally two-way satellite that we run between the head end and the remote sites. Sometimes it's 4G LTE. Sometimes it's, you know, terrestrial internet. Ideally, if you're going to do something, you do, as you mentioned, you do want multiple mechanisms. You do want multiple paths. You know, things like Starlink seem to hold a lot of promise now in terms of providing that backup path. I've often thought that something like Starlink plus LTE would make a pretty robust combination in general. So,
I mean, here's the other thing: you're having to rely on the other end, that their last mile is also as redundant, because if their last mile goes down, you're not getting anything either. And exactly. I think that's why, you know, I think, because we've had these discussions, at least in Wisconsin, with some of the smaller stations, and there's always been a lot of pushback about that. They don't want to have to use the internet. They want to be able to pick this stuff up over the air. So the compromise that we've reached is that the PEPs and the LP1s have a combination of all three. So they've got over the air, they've got internet delivery, and then satellite delivery through, you know, either Premier or the Squawk channel or Sirius XM. So we require them to have three different entry methods in the assumption that, you know, as long as we can get it down the first two levels, the LP1s and the PEPs, well, then, you know, the rest of it will be that much better down the line. Now, we're never going to get it perfect, but we should get it close enough. You know, the issue with internet still is, while it's robust and it's reliable, that's in general. You know, you still have the last mile on both ends. And I don't see a station in, you know, a town of 10,000 people having multiple options that are reliable for receiving such critical information over the internet. FirstNet is helping that a little bit, but you know, I just don't see that up front. And I would have a real concern about relying on the internet entirely for something like that. You know, even as a backup, you know, I'm not even sure. I would still kind of tend to say, if you're, you know, a more important primary station, that makes a lot of sense. But as for some of the just the participating stations, I think that may be prohibitive for them.
Now, you're absolutely right. I mean, that last mile problem cuts both ways. And you're never going to get it 100%. So I agree. I mean, a multi-pronged approach is always going to be best. You know, a combination of over the air IP delivery and satellite delivery.
On the other side, there's a local radio station I know which cannot be fed by a traditional 950 megahertz STL, and it's fed by an internet STL. And guess what? That's more reliable than the transmitter it's feeding.
Oh, I believe it. I've just recently, in fact, this past week, I've moved two more stations over to our central facility. So I've got something like 10 or 12 signals being fed over fiber rather than STL. So I agree. I mean, but that's also, we're a larger group and we can spend the money for two different internet connections coming into the building for high-speed fiber and that sort of thing, which is, you know, within our reach, but probably not within the reach of smaller groups.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. There's an old saying, you know, how's it going to play in Peoria?
I'll be the fly in the ointment here and say, okay, Greenville, Mississippi, which is a technology backwater, we've got fiber coming in the building. And since the day we got, and it took us a year and a half to get it, took the City Planning Commission a year almost to approve digging fiber under the sidewalk. So you know, that's not a technology problem. That's an idiot problem. And well,
there's Ripon, Wisconsin, where I still have cable going to a neighbor 2 miles away, and then a Ubiquiti shot over because it's just not going to happen.
Well, I feel your pain. I got a station right now that the internet's off. It's in Indianola, Mississippi, and we've had wireless ISP. Hasn't been reliable. We had HughesNet, has not been reliable. We have now T-Mobile 5G. There's one T-Mobile in tower and it's down, and T-Mobile knows about it. It's been down for 3 days now. So it's very location dependent, but I'll tell you, in Greenville, Mississippi, we had problems until we got on C Spire fiber, and we've had not a second of downtime in over a year now. Same thing for Cleveland, Mississippi. We actually had fiber going by the radio station for 15 years. We didn't know about it and they wouldn't sell it retail. It was for, infrastructure, you know, a ring around the state of Mississippi. Well, they started selling it retail. We got it and it's been delightful. And just like you, Chris, I'm running an STL on two stations between two cities 40 miles apart, and it's been incredibly reliable, more reliable than any transmitter we've had. Well, except for the brand new ones, but any older transmitter that we've had, more reliable. I guess I'm just saying that internet is here to stay. It does nothing but get better and better and better. And there are ways to get fairly reliable internet. I don't know. What are we delivering to the end user?
On the same token, internet's not a magic bullet. It isn't something that is the be all end all solution to everything. So yeah, that's great. You can get internet. That's fantastic. Do we want to put all of our eggs in that basket when it comes to important messaging, civil messaging? I tend to not believe that. I think that that's a component of it, but I wouldn't put all of my eggs in that basket. You know, regardless of how the audio quality sounds, it's at least listenable. And, you know, as far as something that is going to be more reliable, or at least that we know is going to be pretty reliable, we know that generally those stations are going to be on the air. They're going to be working. We spend a lot of money on generators. And now granted, there are some stations that don't, but they're also not LP2s or LP1s.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, that's kind of what it boils down to. And, you know, one of the discussions we're going to have at WBA this year is AM stations being part of EAS. Is that worth it? Is it not worth it? You know, for those reasons. But I really have a problem with, well, yeah, we got to just throw it all on the internet. That's what it's for. And it's great. It is, it's not infallible. And, yeah, you know, but and nothing is, and that's why I'm saying, you know, we have to use a combination of things to to achieve that 5.9 uptime in the system. And, you know, we're finally getting to that point where we're not relying on just over the air broadcast, but I also don't believe that relying on the internet is the solution either. I think there's a combination of things, again, with the LP1s and the PEPs, where first of all, those are larger stations, usually have the budget to be able to do that. And from there, they generally have the signals that can reach the other stations that aren't, you know, that nobody's monitoring them after that. So as long as those stations can get an LP1 or an LP2 clearly, it doesn't matter what they have feeding that encoder.
I'm going to whine about one more thing, and that is think about all the pieces of high-quality audio gear in your broadcast facility. I realize with EAS equipment, they do need to serve kind of, you know, they need to be a one-size-fits-all, so it's going to be analog ins and outs. It's going to be, or some of them have AES EBU ins and outs. I get that. Mark Persons used to make, you know, relay panels, and we've got some of them at our stations to hit a bunch of stations at the same time that have similar coverage areas. But think about hooking up to the back of any of the brands of EAS gear. Is that really the highest quality connection in your radio station, or okay, is it really just a piece of crap?
Well, first of all, okay, I agree with you. I mean, it pains me when I take my live wire plant and that one hop through the EAS box happens. I usually use AES EBU. However, the overriding feeling to that is the maybe slightly, mostly imperceptible change in audio quality. Is that okay? Consider, you know, compared to the guy being interviewed on TV going, well, I had the radio on, but they didn't say anything about a tornado coming.
Okay. Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's the way I look at it. I'll take the little bit of a hit. And again, I have not been able to get a discernible difference in audio quality.
Well, no, and that's not the different problem. I'm talking about the unbalanced connections coming from stripping some wires and hooking them to the little tiny screwdriver things, and the unbalanced monitor connections on the back. That's what I'm talking about.
If you're doing that, then you're doing it wrong. I mean, then you spend the money and you get individual boxes for each station, and you don't have to deal with that. So
I'm sorry. I mean, the monitor input's coming in.
Oh, sure. Well, you know, but again,
that's where the audio comes from. That's the audio we're putting on the air.
But we know that it's only going to be briefly and for one message. And if that is a problem of the engineer if that's going on, because I certainly don't have that issue in my stations. So that's the thing.
That does bring up another great point. I mean, about monitoring inputs on your index. I'll pick on the index because it's the beast I know. Okay, they are very picky about input levels on those on those monitoring inputs, and I have seen cases where those meters are just pegged coming into the box, and almost to the point where at one point those inputs were so fragile you could literally damage them with an input level that was too high. I think they've fixed that since then, you're right. It does come down to the engineer making sure that they've got the highest quality audio to start with.
Current group of people here aside, I've run into some stations where, and this is a case in a lot of smaller stations, these boxes are intimidating and they're not installed very well because the person installing it doesn't know what they're doing or they can't figure it out. So, I mean, that's another issue is we could certainly work on making these boxes easier to install and easier to work. And, you know, they do have a learning curve. So I think that's part of the issue too, is it's not necessarily inherent in the design of the boxes. Although as you said, Shane, there was an issue where that was the first test, national test. We found out that those input levels were an issue, causing audio being imprinted over other channels to create this double audio thing going on and everything else. So, yeah, I mean, so that, you know, those things exist, but I do think that, like you said, there's a lot of set it and forget it, but there's also a lot of set it and don't even check it. It's like, okay, I got it in, my part's done, I'm walking away.
Yeah. And I've got something to say to that too. And that is that I remember in the 1960s, if I was in New York and I was going to call Los Angeles, I would place the call, and what I would hear is a certain amount of hiss on the line, right, but the voice was very good. And you know darn well, it had to go from microwave tower to microwave tower, probably went through 100 of them to get to the other end of the United States. And yet it was very nice audio, just with a little hiss added to it.
Right, but
100 hops, and it got there nicely.
And that's because the Bell engineers at the time really, really well engineered that system.
They maintained it properly too.
So anyway, on another subject, the receivers feeding some of these boxes sometimes are kind of abysmal as well. I mean, yeah, you've got the really nice ones like the Crowns, but you've also got people out there just putting whatever random thing they can find on these monitor inputs, you know, analog tuners that drift all over the place, things like that.
Or the after a power outage, the receiver comes on, but it doesn't come back on frequency.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Now what?
Yeah. I mean, it was kind of unfortunate when we lost the Dayton Industrial receivers, because those were very nice receivers
for EAS. They were very convenient and priced right.
Yeah. And they just worked.
Yeah. Seems like I've got one that I bought from one of our guests today, and it's still working. It's in the rack, and it's providing an internet feed of the National Weather Service from Nashville, Tennessee, unavailable anywhere else. How about that? Hey, we're having a very lively discussion, and I just stir the pudding to get you to tell me where I'm wrong. And that's great. I appreciate the lively discussion on EAS, and I appreciate the opportunity to voice my displeasure with a lot of it. And you're right. Of course, if you do everything right, it's going to sound a whole lot better. And, you know, a lot of people, I shouldn't include me, a lot of people consider EAS to be, oh, this is an annoyance we've got to do. And so they get, you know, what's the crappiest receiver I can buy that'll work? Work most of the time, and they hook that up, and they twist some wires together, and they think it's working, and we need to treat it well. I guess part of my beef is that all parts of the system seem geared against being high quality. Yes, you can eke some high quality out of it, but why can't these receivers have balanced audio inputs? Why do they have to have a problem where they bleed from one channel to another? These decoders, if you feed it too high. I mean, would that be acceptable with any other piece of equipment in your air chain? I don't think so. So, but maybe it's, we don't want to spend $8,000 on one. Maybe, you know, $2,500 is the most we want to spend on it. So I get it. And a lot of broadcasters feel like, well, this is an unfunded mandate. You know, we're required to do this. We're required to spend money on it. And yet it's got to come out of our pockets. That's another discussion. There may be rights and wrongs about that. Okay. Here's something that's very right. And that is from Henry Engineering, the Henry Engineering Talent Pod. This is a piece of gear that a lot of people just love, especially talent love it. Why? Well, because it works well. It does what you need it to do. The Talent Pod, from Henry Engineering, is an announcer's mic and headphone controller for use by talent at remote broadcasts. It's ideal for use at sporting events or just on-location broadcasts. It solves the problem of providing the talent with a mix of local and return, that's IFB or backhaul, audio for their headphones. It's simply, it allows error-free use by non-technical users. Several of these units can be linked together for use with multiple announcers, like at, you know, very typical sporting events. It provides the announcer a convenient way to turn his mic on or off, and control his headphone audio volume and the mix of, you know, more me or more of the return audio. The on mic on off button is illuminated. There's a cough button, which momentarily mutes the mic audio. And the mic control functions are compatible with any professional dynamic or condenser microphone. It also provides control of the announcer's headphone audio, giving a remote site local audio to be mixed with the return audio that's sent from the site onto the main studio. And these are separate inputs for local and return audio with a volume control for each source. So the talent can adjust the mix in his headphones, and to minimize confusion between the two, The Talent Pods 2's pan switches can independently position local and return audio in the left, center, or right channels. So left or center or right for the announcer's headphones. A lot of conveniences built in there. The Talent Pod 2 also includes a mic preamplifier, which you can use to add an additional mic input to a mixer or use with a codec that has no mic pre and no microphone input and monitor jack. Lots of benefits. And these are available. Of course, they're made by Henry Engineering, and Hank Landsberg just makes amazing stuff to help us as broadcasters. You can get them, though, from Broadcasters General Store. Now, their website, you know it, bgs.cc. Easy to say. It's five little characters. Okay, plus the dot. BGS, six characters if you include the dot, bgs.cc. You can call them at 352-622-7700. 352-622-7700. Great people, low prices, sharp pencils to come up with your quote, and really real accuracy on tracking your order and telling you what's in stock and how soon you'll have it. I love these folks. Spent a week with Buck Waters up in the Pacific Northwest last week, and saw him just yesterday with the SBE in Phoenix. It was remote. We did it remotely, but it was good to be there with Buck Waters. Thanks a lot, BGS, for sponsoring this week in Radio Tech. All right, we got quite a great show going here. Chris Tarr is with us, as usual, taking the high road, insisting on quality, because that's what he does, and that's what we should all be doing if we all aspire to be like Chris Tarr. Shane Toven here, the guy who takes care of, you know, hundreds of facilities. And then Mark Persons, who has been there and done that, and occasionally gives advice on all that stuff. So, okay, have we argued about EAS enough, or was there? Oh yeah, of course. Well, I guess my point was, gee, if we took internet feeds, we solved the quality problem that I complained about. The other things, Chris Tarr says, well, you know, you wouldn't have a quality problem, Kirk, if you did it right, and he's not wrong. Of course, my doing it right depends upon all the other people in the chain before me doing it right as well. So it's, I can do my part. That's true. Shane, I wonder if you could tell me a little bit about how an EMF transmitter site, how you guys handling monitoring of EAS of your assignments at some transmitter site where K-Love or Air One is transmitting from, and there's no studio in sight.
Sure. Well, you know, with hundreds of stations, it's a little bit more difficult to monitor than just, you know, going out and checking the logs every week. So we basically go by whatever's in the statewide plan for monitoring assignments, just like any other broadcaster would. But yeah, it is all self-contained at the transmitter site. So the NDEC is actually out at the transmitter site with the rest of the air chain. It basically talks back to a custom head end that we use to reconcile the logs from all of those units in the field. So the chief operator for each station will every week log into his stations and go through every single one of those units and those logs and look for discrepancies. And actually, the system will flag them automatically if there are any discrepancies on what was expected versus what was received. So it's kind of cool.
Well, that's better than a lot of small stations.
So. Yeah.
I got a question for Chris. Chris, educate me, because I don't know how this works anymore. How do local officials, you've got a local emergency, let's say I used to live in a town, Richmond, Kentucky, that was close to a chemical ordnance depot, and they stored a lot of chemical poison gas there, and they had some accidental releases of that, and it seems like, you know, townspeople got notified on the radio. How does that normally happen where a local official can say, oh my goodness, there's a problem. I need my radio stations in the area to get this information out immediately.
Sure. Well, that we have a nuclear power plant in Wisconsin that has the ability to originate those tests. So there is a path that you take to get onto the IPAWS network for CAP being able to send CAP notifications. It requires, the certificate to be able to send the message. It also, you know, there's a lot of actual physical controls for accountability and those sorts of things. But basically, they have their own encoder, their own CAP encoder. They can type in a message, whatever they need to do, and send it. Now, it's limited to where they can send it based on what kind of facility they are. So that way, you know, we can't do a code here and trigger a station in Texas or something. But anybody, any legally recognized municipality or, you know, power plant or something like that can originate their own messages, can purchase the equipment to do that and participate. But it could also, if they choose not to do that, it then usually falls to the county emergency management or the state emergency management. All of those people can originate messages and will usually do that on behalf of the organization.
Got you. Okay. Well, that seems really critical that local officials have relationships like that they can do. Do they coordinate that through a state agency or do they coordinate that just through the local stations? Sorry, I'm muted.
Oh, now can you hear me? Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Okay. So typically that is determined in your state EAS plan. Typical setup would be like for Amber Alerts, it's DOJ. For emergency, other kind of civil alerts, usually it's the local or the state emergency management agency, and they will coordinate with the other areas in the region. And that's where the committee comes in that I'm the broadcast chair of, is we all meet. I meet with my counterparts in FEMA and Wisconsin EMA and Department of Justice and those sorts of things. And we get together and we make those decisions. Who's going to be responsible for this? Who's responsible for that? If there's something that broadcasters have to participate in, I will take that and make sure that gets implemented. So it really, there's a multitude of agencies that, where this goes on behind the scenes that broadcasters don't really know about. I meet with cable systems, wireless alerts for the cell phones, all those things, all of these stakeholders. We meet a couple times a year to go over these changes and go over the implementation of these things.
Chris, Shane, Mark, maybe you could tell me, is there any way to fix this problem of here I am in Nashville, Tennessee, and I've mentioned this before, and I'm sorry to bring it up again. A child is abducted in Memphis, Tennessee on a Saturday night. Parent didn't return the child like they were supposed to. And Memphis is a 3.5-hour drive to the west-southwest. And because it's a statewide thing with the Tennessee Bureau of Investigation, the alert goes everywhere in Tennessee, including to Bristol, Tennessee, which is nearly a 10-hour drive away. The kid ain't there, I'm telling you. The kid is almost very likely in Mississippi, where the alert doesn't go, and Arkansas, where the alert doesn't go. Why do these child abduction emergency alerts have to be state-based and not region or polygon-based?
Well, I can answer that. They're not supposed to be. I mean, they are supposed to be region-based, and in Wisconsin, okay, they are. I can tell you that, and again, I can't speak for every other state because each state is on their own. But in Wisconsin, we have a very comprehensive plan about how even alerts are originated. Not anybody can do an Amber Alert because a kid was taken. There's a very specific set of things that have to happen. The law enforcement agency sends it to the DOJ at the state, and they have to approve it. And they don't approve everyone. But what they will try to do is, first of all, they'll do the region that the event took place in. And then if they have an idea of direction of travel or, for example, where this person may be going, they will light it up in those parts of the state. So even though maybe there was an abduction in Milwaukee, if they know that the person who did the abduction has relatives in Green Bay, it'll trigger the alerts in Green Bay and everywhere in between. So the answer to your question is you as a broadcaster need to work with my counterpart in your state, find out who that is and bring that up. And again, after every Amber Alert here in the state, I get together with the DOJ and some other people, and we go over that particular event and what did the alerts work? Were they, was there a problem with how they were issued or where they went? And so we do a forensic analysis after every Amber Alert to go over those things. And if your state isn't doing it, you need to turn up the pressure with the people involved to make sure that that does happen.
Wow.
Yeah, excellent. Absolutely. And most other states have a similar type of plan in place where it has to go through multiple levels of approval before it actually gets issued. Although there are some states where, as you've mentioned, Kirk, where they just cast such a wide net that it really becomes almost a case of crying wolf. So that, again, is a case where, you really do have to, as a broadcaster, work with your local emergency management facilities, authorities, along those lines. We've had there were reports recently of an Amber Alert, I think it was in Florida, that went out at some really bizarre time of morning. And it went out not only to CAP and to EAS, it went out to WEA sure. as well,
sure.
which is, you know, a separate system for EAS, but it's still tied into CAP and the overall IPAWS alerting stuff. But so many people just got so annoyed when their phone went off at like 2 o'clock in the morning with this, you know, with the alert tone, the attention tone, that they were just, you know, they were kind of livid about it. So if that's happening in your state, definitely work with your local,
well, and that results in people turning that off on their phone. As many phones, you exactly. can turn that off.
Exactly.
And I mean, it's happened time and time again. He's sitting in church at Forest Hills Baptist Church, 8:45 in the morning, and your WEA, I mean, a bunch of phones in the congregation all go off. Same Amber Alert. Everybody's getting the same one. And it's somebody out of Memphis, Tennessee. It's a 3.5-hour drive away. And I promise you, the kid is not if they're in Tennessee, they're in Shelby County. They're not.
Well, generally, Amber Alert should never go over WEA. So if that's happening, somebody made a mistake.
In this case, it was, in fact, an accident. Yeah,
well, it's happened more than once. That's good to know. You know, there's so much. I can see that it works better in some places than in others. That's for sure. And Chris sounds
absolutely
analyze that.
And to be honest, I can't take credit for that. Gary Tim has been a leader in this for years and years and years. He was the chair. And I just took over earlier this year, and Gary's a good friend of mine. I've known him for years, and he was really the guy and really actually set the standard for a lot of states, working with the FCC. He was into this early on, and you know, that's why Wisconsin really has a really solid program that a lot of other states kind of emulate and that the FCC uses as an example, all because of Gary's work. And he has done just a fantastic job.
That's awesome. Wow. Okay. Gentlemen, we're going to have time for one more quick break and come back with some final words. And we got to get this band back together again. This is amazing. We can talk offline later on and see you know, when we can get us all back together. But I just feel like between Chris, Shane, Mark, we got a group that really gels here, and I'm just here to stir the pudding. So you guys are just awesome. Our show is brought to you in part by a couple of great sponsors. One of them's Angry Audio, and I'm going to be tagging on Chris here in a second to say something about Angry Audio. The other's Max Connect Wireless. Chris, are you in a good position to tell us about Angry Audio this week?
I am always in a good position to talk about Angry Audio. I am really, really super excited because on Facebook the other day was an example of Corny using the new mic processor. He was using the Chameleon Smooth, and the Smooth is because of the SM in the beginning, standing for SM7 or SM5 or even the MV series like this. Basically, Corny and Catfish got together and said, we need to make a mic processor, but how's the best way to do that? And they thought about it and they went, well, if we know what mic it's going to connect to, we can customize the processor for the particular dynamics of the microphone, of the, you know, all the peculiarities and the idiosyncrasies of that particular microphone and make a processor that sounds fantastic right out of the box. And then we can add a couple of controls in there to tailor it for each person. But you could take this out of the box, you could plug it in and start talking, and it's going to sound fantastic. And that is their new processor series. There is the Smooth, SM for SM7, and the Rebel, which is RE for the RE27, the RE20. And my understanding is even some of the other microphones from these lines, the SM and the RE, for other microphones using similar capsules, they'll work with those as well. And each mic processor has two inputs. You can do two microphones with it, I think. Now, I may have spoken on term on that one. I think it does. But either way, it has a few controls on the front and a great front panel. So you take the front panel off, you do your tweaking, you make it sound the way you want. You put the front panel on and you walk away, and it's going to sound great every single time, no matter who speaks into it. There's also some really cool new DSP tools that Corny has written. One of them is they call it room size, and it's actually like a voice gate, but they basically shrink the size of the room dynamically. It's really cool. Instead of a gate that just kind of opens and closes at a certain threshold, it actually uses DSP to almost change audibly the size of the room to the point where it just naturally sounds like there's no room noise without that clipping in and out, and that, you know, you can hear the room noise go, you know, appear and disappear, things like that. They fixed those in DSP. It's very fascinating. I've heard Courtney do it on Facebook. He did a recording with it. It sounded fantastic. I'm hoping to get one here to hook up to my microphone, and we'll do a tour episode with it. Fantastic stuff. Go to angryaudio.com. They've got the Rebel for the RE20 and the Smooth for the SM7. Some great new Chameleon processors from Angry Audio. You can check them out at angryaudio.com. You can get them from your favorite broadcast distributor, such as BGS. Problems disappear when you get angry. Don't get frustrated. Get angry. Angryaudio.com.
Thank you so much, Chris. Thanks to Angry Audio. I can't wait to hear. I saw Corny doing that video. I need to go back and actually listen to it. I was on my cell phone at the time, so I want to get some better audio. Hey, Max Connect Wireless is another sponsor of ours, and Gary Morrill, our friend, is here to tell you about it. Gary?
I'm Gary Morrill, Midwest Regional Director of Engineering for Alpha Media. When I first spoke with Josh Bone about Max Connect, he told me they'd work great for remote transmitter sites where connectivity was a challenge. And you know, he's absolutely right. We even have sites where we're using this as a backup to our STL using Max Connect's dual carrier option, and it works perfectly. We also have times where we need to be able to get out to a venue where it's kind of challenging because everybody and his brother is trying to stream video at the same time, like at a big sporting event. And you know what? Our data gets through every time because it's prioritized packet data. It works for us. It'll work for you. Max Connect. Check it out.
I've got a station right now that I wish I had this at right now. We got a little problem at one of our stations out in the sticks, and Max Connect would definitely work there, especially when you get a choice of carriers. We've got a T-Mobile tower down right now, but this particular one I've got in my hand will do either AT&T or Verizon because those are the SIM cards in there. Max Connect Wireless. Go to Max Connect. I know it's spelled funny. MaxxConnect.com. And you can read all about it there. Thanks, Josh Bone, for supplying the broadcast industry with reliable and prioritized and static IP packet delivery. Appreciate you very much. Max Connect Wireless. All right. Well, we got a couple minutes left. Not much, though. Let's hit back. Let's see what Shane and Mark are doing. Mark, I'm sorry. You got a few words in edgewise. Shane and Mark, I'm wondering what you might have to offer us as a tip of the week or a final parting thought.
Tip of the day. Well, what about the signaling on your phone? Now, Kirk, if you'll call me, you'll understand what my ringtone is. And let's try it out on every phone here, one at a time.
I'm calling you now.
Now, since we're all hams, we know that is CQ. And I'm trying to call and see if anyone out there would like to answer.
You know what would be cool, Mark? What if you're a ham or if you know Morse code, ham or not, you could set your ringtone to... I wonder if there's a way to make it spell out the name of the person calling you.
You could do that.
Yeah. Sure, you could do that.
The free app that I found, or the free tones that I found, were just available as CQ. And I suppose if I was pretty creative, I could make one of my own, and maybe six of my own for each one of the persons involved.
Have you ever, we've been talking about EAS so much. Have you ever heard somebody whose ringtone are the EAS duck farts? You sure wouldn't want to get that on a microphone on the air anywhere. But I've been to SBE meetings where, you know, I was proudly shown, here's my ringtone. And it was EAS duck farts.
I do remember back in the beginning of EAS, the weekly message without the voice was described as the silent EAS message. Now, how could that be called silent?
Oh, Shane, got some parting wisdom for us. We know where Mark stands.
Sure. So I guess if I could offer one takeaway, you know, the internet is great, but never put all of your eggs in one basket.
Good point. I think that's what Chris was saying, too. Chris, why don't you cap it off with some frosting on the top of this cake?
Shane is the smartest guy I know.
Thank you, Chris.
Well, okay, so is Mark. Mark is also the smartest person smartest I know. Guy, you
know. Superlative city here. All right, gentlemen, thank you so much. We got to get, this is a great band. I mean, I'm just here to, you know, to pick a few songs to sing, and you guys just do great. I really appreciate you very much. Chris Tarr, our co-host on most every show. Chris, hey, next week, let me tell you, Chris, who's on the show next week. Hang on one second. I got to find it. Tyler Everett of Pippin in Saskatchewan, Canada is going to be our guest. And their little office has invented a pretty cool little piece of gear. So he's going to kind of bring us up to date on what they're doing in Canada, especially as it regards audio over IP and signaling over Ethernet packets. So that's going to be... it's going to be pretty cool. And Shane Tobin, thank you for being with us. And I'm glad you're able to take an hour and a half out from your vacation in Minnesota. Go visit and visit Mark. That's super cool. Wish I was there. We should all get together at Mark's house. Mark, why don't you invite us all up?
And you've taken an hour and a half out of my retirement, by the way.
Oh, no. Well, Mark, thanks to you, and thanks to your sweet wife, Paula, for letting us have you for an hour.
You're welcome.
Oh, okay. Good, good. All right. Hey, we got to go. Thanks to Suncast for producing today's show. He does so much better than I do. All the mics work right. So thank you very much, Suncast. And next week we'll be back with Tyler Everett from Canada. Oh, and speaking of Canada, Brian Clemens, by the way, mentioned, and it'd be good to figure out exactly what he means. He says in Canada, all they have for emergency is internet delivery, no over-the-air alerts. I guess he means no over-the-air backhaul station to station. So I'd be interested to find out, you know, how that works in Canada and how it works practically speaking. So Brian Clemens, sorry I didn't get that message on earlier, but thank you for letting us know that. A lot of research to do. Okay, we got to go. We'll see you next week on This Week in Radio Tech. Bye-bye.